Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana Lafayette Press and the Hellas Foundation. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Alciclus Ozels and John Kemp about their new book, Alciclus Ozels, The Romantic Realism of an Artist and Teacher. We'll also hear from Bill Lavender about the upcoming New Orleans Poetry Festival. It's a great pleasure to welcome Alciclus Ozels and John Kemp to The Reading Life. Alciclus is a renowned artist and teacher, founder and director of the New Orleans Academy of Fine Arts, and the creator of a body of work that includes gorgeous landscapes and still lifes and portraits and murals that are in many museums and private collections. John Kemp is the former deputy director of the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities and the former chief curator of the Louisiana State Museum's Historical Center in New Orleans. He's written numerous books and articles, and together, they are the creators of a gorgeous new book, Alciclus Ozels, The Romantic Realism of an Artist and Teacher. Welcome to The Reading Life, Alciclus.
Thank you so much.
You too, John.
Thank you.
Welcome back, John.
It's great to be here.
So how did you two meet, and how did this book come about?
Actually, our relationship began probably about 25 years ago, when I wrote an article about your work for American Artist Magazine.
Yes, of course.
Artist Magazine. And then we did one for Louisiana Life Magazine. Then we've done others over the years, Plain Air Magazine and others. And then we actually featured you among 100 or so artists in this unique slant of light, which was a bicentennial history of art in Louisiana. So I've always been an admirer of your work and always enjoyed talking with you.
Great
stories.
Also, I think you were the Southern representative for Art News.
Yes, I was New Orleans correspondent for Art News.
Yeah, correspondent, yes.
That's correct.
You did a piece on New Orleans artists in Art News, and that's sort of the number one. That's the magazine that everybody reads and watches to see what the latest ism is coming down from New York.
So what was the final impetus to make you settle down and do this book?
Well, we had coffee one day.
We did.
On Magazine Street, not too far from the Academy.
Yeah.
And we talked about the possibility of doing a book together, which, you know, I was, you know, very enthusiastic to do because, as I said, I've written about your work. I knew your work and I knew your life story and the fact that you founded the Academy and the artists that you're turning out there. So really, there was a story to be told there, and a really good story, not to mention some fabulous art to show.
Well, thank you so much, John. For an artist to still be alive and have a book published with his work is a big thrill.
Now, Alciclus, I have to ask you, your life story is so fascinating. Born in pre-war Latvia, fled ahead of the Soviet armies to Germany. Your family was briefly interned at Dachau.
Yes.
And that's just amazing that you escaped and then arrived in the United States with your family in 1950. Do you ever just look back at all this and think, oh, what
often,
an amazing life?
Often, of course, it's becoming more distant as time goes by. But I think back so many times and wonder if all of those Eastern Europeans that left Eastern Europe, hundreds of thousands of them, if they could have gone back home, what might have happened. Mm-hmm. I very often say to my friends, in 1945 at Yalta, if FDR had not given all of Eastern Europe to Stalin, then there wouldn't have been any New Orleans Academy of Fine Arts.
That's true.
Whoa.
That's true.
Cause and effect.
Yeah, that's right.
Well,
we're lucky, weren't we?
We're very lucky. So at what moment did you really know that art was your destiny, that you would make this your life? Your mother was an artist.
Yes, my mother was creative. My father was an agronomist, a pragmatist. But as I grew up, I was very lucky in Trenton, New Jersey. Trenton had quite a history of the Delaware River painters were active there at that time. And And I sort of lucked into a lot of really fine teachers that eventually recommended the Pennsylvania Academy in Philadelphia. But I loved architecture also, and I studied architecture for a few years before switching to the fine arts completely, because the design part of architecture is so wonderful, but when you have to start dealing with electrical schedules and plumbing schedules, it becomes less creative and less interesting. Mm-hmm.
And to me, more mysterious.
Yeah.
I mean. Now, John really captures your belief in what are the appropriate foundations of artistic training. And I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about what you bring as a teacher, your teaching philosophy.
Well, there's been a tradition for centuries that the human figure contains all the secrets of nature, and therefore it's been sort of the basis of study for centuries, you know, going all the way back to Greece and even, of course, Egypt. And so the idea is that if you understand the human figure and the human body, since it is sort of the ultimate realization of, if you believe in evolution or creation, then you can master anything.
Mm-hmm.
Landscapes, animals, or pretty much anything. That's why it's been a standard of study for so many years.
And you said that you only go so long before you have to stop and paint a nude and return to those fundamentals.
Exactly, yeah. Very often when people look at my book or when I make a presentation of my paintings, they say to me, what are you, a landscape painter or a portrait painter or a still life painter and so forth? And I always like to bring up the fact that today in medicine, we don't have too many GPs, general practitioners, any longer.
That's true.
We have specialists and so forth. And I like to say that, well, I'm sort of like Degas and Van Gogh, and they painted landscapes, they painted still lives, they did etchings, engravings, and so forth. So I'm a GP painter, general practitioner painter, because I still love the world around me. To me, creation, to me, God's creation is the most important thing.
And you've said that part of your job is teaching your students how to see.
Exactly. It's all about the art of seeing. And there's so many methods that have been passed down to us, starting with the early academies, like one of the first academies called Accademia di San Luca in Rome, and then, of course, the Royal Academy in London, and Ecole de Beaux Arts, and so forth. And they all had a certain pattern of study, of certain curricula that were extremely important. And the Pennsylvania Academy of Fine Arts in Philadelphia, the earliest art school in America, most of their instructors and teachers studied abroad in Europe and brought back these ideas to America. And I was fortunate enough to study there. So I have maintained these and tried to incorporate them into our curriculum at the Academy.
What you've done, Alciclus, is to create a community, you know, and I wonder if you'd comment a little bit on the artist community in New Orleans and how rich and diverse it is and how you feel about it. Either one of you can go.
Well, you know, that there are more art galleries and professional and working artists in New Orleans today than at any time in the history of New Orleans. Even in the late 19th century, when the arts were really sort of blooming, the visual arts were blooming in New Orleans. But since the 1970s or so, it has just—it's become a major force, mm-hmm. a much creative force in New Orleans, and it's really wonderful to see, and wonderful to follow, and wonderful to write about. And one thing you had asked us earlier about teaching his students how to see—that was the one great thing I got, or one of the many great things I have gotten from writing about artists such as Alciclus. Artists teach you how to see the world around you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my interest in the past is always writing about New Orleans history and so forth. But when I started writing about artists and how they see the world, they teach you how to see the world around you. I mean, the most insignificant little thing becomes beautiful all of a sudden. You're driving down a highway, you see a tree, a formation, you begin to frame it in your own mind, yeah, as a work of art. And that's been a wonderful benefit,
yeah,
from this sort of thing.
There's an interesting thing that happened in the 1950s in America. With the advent of abstract expressionism, there's a remarkable thing that happened, because artists up to that time mostly, not all, but mostly, looked outside of themselves, around the world around them, at landscape and still life and portraits at other human beings and animals and mm-hmm. the sky and clouds and so forth for their inspiration. And somewhere in the late 50s, early 60s, it started to change, where artists were, in a sense, encouraged to look inside instead of outside, to sort of almost neglect the world around them, but to look inside into their own psyches and their own internal, you know, mental mechanisms, and start to come up with new ideas and new things. And I guess that was sort of the birth of that expression, conceptual art. But then again, what is a concept? I've always wondered about that, because what's the difference between a concept and an idea? Pretty much the same thing.
Now, you said in the introduction that there's a perception that you don't like modern art, but you know what modern art is. You choose to do what you do.
Of course, I grew up with it. I grew up with all the major proponents. And like in the 60s, you had, you know, Harold Rosenberg. And and in graduate school, they came to lecture, many of them, and the proponents of abstractionism and op art and minimalism and all of that. Any painting, whether it's realistic or not, still to have any value, has to have three things. One is the technical, the other is the aesthetic, and then the emotional, which comes from the person. Who's that wonderful English art critic? John Ruskin. He called it the hand, the head, and the heart. Mm-hmm. These are the three elements. The technical is the knowledge of your craft. And of course, the aesthetic is the organization of line, pattern, texture, pattern, and form within a given space, according to these tenets of composition, whatever you've learned. And the idea is to present a chromatically organized piece of work, whether it's realistic or not. It doesn't matter. It can be a beautiful thing, whether it's an abstraction or... Here's that problematic, troublesome word, abstract, which has been evolving over the years. And my favorite Mark Twain quote is, "I'm sorry I wrote you such a long letter. I didn't have time to write a short one." So to say things concisely and simply is a true abstraction, like the abstract in a legal presentation. So to get down to the essential characteristics of something is a true abstraction. But that term has evolved now just to mean sort of having a lot of fun with space and color and textures and so forth. But a great abstraction in a painting still has to have chromatic coherency and a organized system of design and a beginning and a middle and an end, just like a good book. A good painting has to have a beginning and middle and an end when you're looking at it.
Speaking of a good book, so how did you two decide how to put this book together? How did you organize the paintings? And talk a little bit about going through your work and looking at it in that way.
That was fun, wasn't it?
It was a lot of fun. For me, it was especially important because over the years, my instructors and my teachers never talked about their own work in public ever, because that was up to somebody else. And I was fortunate enough to meet Edward Hopper at one time, and he was one of the most self-effacing and quiet and dignified men that would never talk about his own work and the quality of his own work, even if he was asked. I inherited that from a lot of my professors, that quality. I've tried to maintain that, but since what I call digitalis, since digitalis came in, before that, you know, things are on slides.
Yeah.
And I never really did a good job in maintaining my slides and so forth. So when John came along, we had to start searching for work. Mm-hmm. And since digital photography, I've done a lot of my own photography. So I had a good body that we could choose from and select from. And so forth. But then I did find a lot of slides with, I thought, important work that we could scan and use. But there's so much of it still out there that I don't know where it is.
Yeah, we literally went through hundreds and hundreds of slides and paintings, because we wanted to represent all of his work, the full body of his work, from the portraits, landscapes, still lifes, and murals. So it was great for me. I got to see so many of his wonderful paintings over the years. So we went literally on numerous occasions. We met and went through hundreds and hundreds of slides.
Oh, what fun. Yeah,
it was.
You spent so much time together working on this book. So what did you learn from each other I mean, this is a it's an act of trust on your part to surrender your work to John to write about. And John, it's a terrific responsibility to take on that work.
You know, to write about an artist of Alcic's, you know, stature and abilities, you know, you really have to tell the story, try to tell it well, so it's an invitation for readers to really get into the work, to understand what the artist is all about, and what the artist is trying to accomplish. And so it's a tremendous responsibility. So it's plus it was very pleasurable for me to sit with him, because he's an art historian. It's amazing, his knowledge of art history. And I learned a great deal from just listening to him and seeing his work and how he composes his work and how he structures his work.
Well, I was just saying, I took this book around to book clubs recently to talk about gift books and the beautiful books of this season, and it was so much fun to watch people look at it.
Yeah.
Because they would look, they go, oh, I mean, they would actually exclaim at the beauty of these paintings. And part of it was the beauty of the painting, and part of it was familiarity, because it looks like home, so many of these paintings do. And that's kind of what we want art to do, is to make us see things in a new way.
All my flower paintings, all those flowers are all from things that grow around in my neighborhood. Very often, if I don't know a neighbor, sometimes I get up at 4 a.m. where it's still dark, and if something is hanging out over a fence, you know, it's not illegal to cut off a thing or two, you see. And besides growing most of them myself, and flowers that come from gardens of friends, and so it's all here.
Great artist and flower thief. I like it.
So if they see you wandering around in the morning,
they'll know.
Just leave them alone, huh?
These flowers were being sacrificed for a greater good.
That's right.
Well, we've been talking with artist Alcicles Ozels and writer John Kemp about their beautiful book, Alcicles Ozels, The Romantic Realism of an Artist and Teacher. Thank you both so much.
Well, thank you, Susan.
Thank you so much.
Where I got me a date with a pretty little girl from Greece. She promised she'd be right there with me when I paint my masterpiece.
I am so happy to welcome Bill Lavender back to The Reading Life, poet, publisher, and today, speaking as one of the founders of the New Orleans Poetry Festival, which is coming up soon. Bill, welcome back.
Thanks so much. Always a pleasure to be here.
You know, I think Bill Lavender is the perfect name for a poet. I do. When I think of poets, I think Bill Lavender. So talk about this festival, which has grown and grown. So what's coming up this year?
Well, we're pretty excited about our feature lineup this year. Our main feature on Saturday night is Anne Waldman, who you know, is sort of the first lady of American poetry now. You know, she co-founded the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics at Naropa University. She co-founded it with Allen Ginsberg in 1974. She has 5 or 6 books out from Penguin, so several with Coffee House Press, and lots of others with other small presses. So we're really excited that she's going to be our main feature on Saturday, April 20.
And she's coming with a musical group.
That's right. She's actually going to be part of our Poets with Bands show on the Saturday.
So what will people see when they see Poets with Bands? Bill, you are a poet with a band, the Call Girls.
So. I am. That's one of the reasons the festival exists, that we needed a place for the Call Girls to play. But the main feature event on Saturday night, April 20, at Siberia, we'll have Kalamu Ya Salaam. We'll open it up with the reading and performance, and then Anne and her band Fast Speaking Music will perform. Then we'll have Skin Verb, which is poet Brett Evans' band. And then my band, the Call Girls, will close it down loudly.
Stay up late with the poets.
That's right. I want to see you there pogoing now.
Now, one of the things I love about this festival is that it's so democratic. The poets bring their ideas to you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, we asked them for ideas, and they submit proposals for panel discussions, readings, workshops, and Megan Burns and I and the board sit down and review them and accept most of them, and that's how it gets rolling. I mean, we get all these people involved.
And one demand you had this year was for more spaces for people to read. So the Dragonfly is going to be hosting this marathon poetry reading.
Yeah, that's right. We're actually running 4 days this year. It starts off Thursday, April 18th from noon to 5 at the Dragonfly with just kind of an open studio registration and meet and greet. That's at the Dragonfly Poetry and Performance Ritual Space at 3921 St. Claude.
Which has become a really important venue for poets in New Orleans.
It has, yeah. Megan started it last year and has been running it successfully for this year now. And it's a perfect space. It's right down the street from our main venue, which is the Healing Center.
One of the things I think is so great about this festival is that the panels range from so many different aspects of poetry. Like there are things about the epic poem. So if you want to write a long poem,
yeah,
you can go and
mm-hmm.
talk about that.
Mm-hmm.
There are exercise workshops, like Andrea Panzica is doing a workshop where you go out and have
exactly.
an experience and
yeah.
then come back.
Yeah,
they
walk around the neighborhood and do various exercises and produce poems. She's
and
repeating
meditate.
That.
I mean.
Yeah, she's repeating that by popular demand from last year. Yeah.
And then there's a lot about poets of resistance,
mm-hmm.
which is a continued theme and will be probably for quite a long time.
Right.
And poets and ecology.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really, there's just so much there. And one interesting thing is the Adoptee Book Club, which I found so interesting. That
yeah, that one was fascinating. I mean, we were we're very interested when we saw that one come.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So poets who have been adopted will gather and talk about that experience
exactly.
and writing about
uh-huh.
it. You have lots of international poets coming this year, don't you?
Yeah, we have so many that Friday night we decided to have an international feature reading where we have some pretty interesting people. Pierre Joris and Nicole Perrafitte
mm-hmm.
are returning and will be doing a kind of joint program there with their multilingual, multinational sensibility. We also have Salgado Maranhão from Brazil. Salgado is quite a figure in Brazil. I'd say he's about as famous in Brazil as Ann Waldman is here.
Wow.
He's a pop cultural figure. Mm-hmm. His work has been recorded and set to music by many of Brazil's more famous recording artists. He's been translated into English, German, Italian, French, Swedish, and Japanese. Fascinating guy, and also will be launching his new book, Palavra,
mm-hmm.
translated by Alexis Levitin, who will also be there.
So talk a little bit for us about the book fair. What can people expect to find there? You've added some new publishers this year, right?
Yeah, there will be lots and
special.
Lots of books for sale. We'll have about 40 tables, and the majority of them are small press publishers who will be displaying their wares, and they'll be for sale there. Also, Candace at Tubby and Coos will have a kind of general table set up where lots of people will be consigning books. And
that's great.
Yeah, it'll the book fair is really the kind of the center of the event, and as we always imagined it. And that runs all day Saturday and Sunday, the 20th and 21st.
So this is a lot of work for you and Megan. I mean, it goes on all year long. So what does it add to your life as a poet?
Well, a lot. I mean, I've made so many friends and connections, and, the support we've received from poets all over the world has really been quite stunning. Megan and I conceived the idea one night at BJ's mm-hmm. When she just said, the Philadelphia poetry festival is coming up. And she said, why don't we have a poetry festival? And I said, well, why don't we just start one? And so from that innocuous conversation began this whole enterprise. It's really something, yeah.
Well, I'm very proud of you and very happy for you. It's a great thing to have on the calendar.
It
is. Every poetry month.
That's right. Yeah, every poetry month.
So making New Orleans the poetry capital of
the world.
That's the goal.
That's our goal. Yes, it is.
Oh, we've been talking with Bill Lavender about the New Orleans Poetry Festival, which is now in its fourth year. Check out nolapoetry.com and head out to St. Claude Avenue this weekend and see for yourself. Bill, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'd rather be thin than famous. I don't want to be fat. And a woman throws me out of bed calling me Gordo. And every time I bend to pick up my suspenders from the Davenport floor, I explode loud, huge grunto and disgust everyone in the familio. I'd rather be thin than famous, but I'm fat. Paste that in your Broadway show.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Here in New Orleans, Clive Wilson discusses and signs Time of My Life, a jazz journey from London to New Orleans, Tuesday, April 16th at 6 at Octavia Books. Gwendolyn Womack discusses and signs The Time Collector, Tuesday, April 16th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The Algiers Library presents a reading, Spring into Poetry, with poets Ingrid Green, Russell McLaren, Phyllis Perrin, and Valentine Pierce, Wednesday, April 17th, at the Algiers Regional Library. Also, this weekend is the New Orleans Poetry Festival and Small Press Book Fair, which takes place Thursday through Sunday, April 18th through 21st, at the New Orleans Healing Center. That's at 2372 St. Claude Avenue. And check out the Dragonfly, 3921 St. Claude, where many poets will be reading. The festival opens Thursday with a poetry reading at the Dogfish Reading Series, 2448 North Villery. Barrister's Gallery at 2331 St. Claude will host a visual poetry exhibition. International poets appear Friday night at Cafe Istanbul at 7 and Saturday night at Siberia at 7. There will be a wonderful reading featuring Kalamu Ya Salaam, along with poet Anne Waldman and her musical group, Fast Speaking Music. Then we'll have the Poets with Band show featuring Skin Verb and the Call Girls. And throughout the weekend, browse the book fair at the New Orleans Healing Center. Check out nolapoetry.com for the complete schedule and tickets. The West Feliciana Parish Children's Book Festival takes place all day Saturday, May 4th in St. Francisville. Check out that complete schedule at conundrumbooks.com. And mark your calendar for the 6th annual Walker Percy Weekend in St. Francisville starting Friday, May 31st through Sunday, June 2nd, with panels, an exhibition of Walker Percy photos, and other events throughout the town's historic district. There will be lots of bourbon on hand. Watch for the complete schedule at conundrumbooks.com. This event sells out quickly. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press, and the Hellas Foundation. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life are by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Engmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org.